Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to comedian and radio presenter, PJ Gallagher.
And then my dad would have to take them to mass. So my dad had this car, like this old Ford Cortina, you know.
Yeah.
Like the regular Cortina. And like him, so there's like the seven men in this fucking thing going to St. John's Church in Clontarf. Like, and them all piling out. And then, of course, none of them got to mass. They just got there and walked away. Including the old fella who just goes to the fucking pub. You know, and then they come back and you're like, what's going on here? Like, yeah, people, and then my ma's like, where are they? I don't know. Like, it was just absolutely bats. Yeah. Like, you know, and you, some people would just, you know, one guy, Danny, would just get out of the car and come home. And he didn't want to go to mass in the first place. What are you making forcing grown adults to go to mass for?
PJ lives in Clontarf in Dublin with his two dogs, Wendy and Stella. And in this conversation, he talks about being adopted, his unconventional upbringing, how he's more flight than fight, and how he struggles with feelings of self-worth. He adores dogs, bikes, Bohemians Football Club and small talk, but he isn't a fan of hugging. He's hilarious and searingly honest, and this conversation is as real as it gets. PJ, I'm chuffed that you're here today. Thanks a million for saying yes to this chat.
No problem. Yeah. No, it's not a big deal to say yes. When you know, I wanted to do it.
So we are currently experiencing like the hottest days of our lives is what I feel at the moment. It's very warm and it's lovely, but I'm expecting, so I'm kind of struggling in the heat. How are you getting on? Because I know you have dogs as well. How are they managing the heat?
No, they don't like the heat very much, you know. Yeah. Well, one of them is not, she's all right, but she's in getting an operation today. I don't know what I was doing with her, but she stood on something and got something in her paw.
Okay.
So she's not well. So as soon as we're finished here, I have to go and collect her.
Yeah.
So that's it. But they're grand. I mean, we're all grand. Like, you're 6 months pregnant, I'm wearing a pair of jeans, I'm slightly uncomfortable in jeans, so I'm looking at the brighter side of things. They have four and they have a paddling pool, so things are all good. Yeah,
well, I think a lot of good pet owners are aware, but like the heat and your dogs or whatever type of pet you have, it's not always like their friend, so you need to kind of keep an eye out for
them. Well, you forget their body runs a lot harder than ours, I think, a lot of the time. And then, you know, the hot pavement, you know, the general rule, stick the back of your hand onto the pavement. If that's a bit hot for you, it's going to be even hotter for them. So that's the thing too. So I'm all mad about dogs. I'm not, like, people are all right, but dogs are fantastic, you know.
Dogs are everything. Is it three you have?
No, two. I had three. I lost one of them in November last year.
So sorry.
Oh, it's horrible. Oh my God, it's so horrible. I know, I'm one of these people. Dogs are family, like.
I'm not
one of these lie down with dogs, get up with fleas. Lie down with dogs, get up with ease. You know, they are family. So they sleep in the bed and they sleep wherever they can. If you're a visitor to the house or a visitor to their house, and this dog was one of the first dogs that was like, I nearly said rented. No, that was adopted out of Dog's Trust.
Yeah, okay.
And so I had a really big attachment to her and it was horrible saying goodbye to her. Like,
yeah,
it was horrible. I had so much stand-up and all based on this dog because, you know, when I was writing shows, this animal was like the greatest personality in my life at the time because it was the only person I could practice stuff on and they wouldn't say that shit.
Yeah.
And because they're there for the entire process. Yeah, so I get very, very attached.
And I mean, you've had dogs, I believe, your entire life.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, you could mark me life through the dogs I've had, you know.
Yeah.
First dog, and they all have had unusual names that kind of didn't suit them. Like, I had an Alsatian called Tara, and then I had a boy collie called Saoirse, and I've had all these. It's always been a random sort of potluck of name. It's like the dog came out of one barrel and the name came out of another, and that was it. You were just stuck on what it was. But I've never been without a dog. A house isn't a home without them, I don't think.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's the closest to family I'll ever have. You know, I got married and I wasn't very good at that, but I'm very good with animals. I'm very good. I understand that relationship very, very well.
Yeah.
So when I look back through, I would say I nearly have chapters to my life, and those chapters are the dogs. So there's the Tara years, the Saoirse years, the Lilo years, the Wendy years, the Stella years.
Yeah. I appreciate that. And I think anyone who's a dog lover who's had dogs will get what you're saying. Some people just don't. They don't get it.
Yeah, you know, they don't get it. Non-dog people don't get it at all. One of my friends, Stephanie Preisner, you know Stephanie Preisner? She's a good friend of mine. Like,
She doesn't get it.
Okay. Like, she doesn't get it. To her, it's like having a seagull in the house. Like, she just thinks it's this wild, raving animal who's likely to fuck up your bins and just make a mess and shite on your couch. That's all she sees. She sees this machine that wants to rob your dinner and shit in your couch. That's all she sees. So she does not get it. No matter how much I say, no, I'm really, like, I mean, given the choice between you or the dog is winning, and she's like, this is insane. I'm a human being. I'm like, yeah, but the dog's family. She doesn't get it. You know, she just doesn't get it. Like, even when I'm sitting down next to her and we're having coffee, we go for coffee all the time, you know. That's our relationship. We meet up, have coffee, tell each other our problems, and then go our separate ways, you know, carry each other's bags away, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And like, we're chatting, and the dog comes up. Of course, I'm reaching forward, and she's like, this, like, it's like a lion. You know, it's like this wild thing has just come out of the savannah wearing a collar. Like, she's just terrified of it. Doesn't get it.
Yeah.
And that's fair enough. I kind of have to remember that too, you know.
That's it. People have a valid fear of dogs.
It's
for
not even
reasons.
A fear. It's just like a genuine dislike. It's like if you came in here to do the podcast and for some reason your uncle was sitting in the corner, I'd be fucking weirded out by that. I'd be like, why did she bring her uncle? Like, this is the strangest dynamic to a podcast ever. I'd be like, why on earth did Sheila Shoger turn up with an uncle? Like, that's what she sees it like. It's like you're bringing this furry uncle around with you and it's disturbing the natural dynamic of conversation.
Funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
See, you mentioned it there, and I don't like. Look, you tell me to feck off if you don't want to go there. But I know that, you know, you were married. You're not now. But
well, no, I'm still married. So we haven't gone through the formalities of.
Oh, have you not?
Yeah, but we're separated.
Excuse me. Sorry.
No, it's grand. No, there's no sensitivities here at all. We're best of friends.
See,
we're still the best of mates. You know.
That's what I sense from you. Anytime I've ever heard you speak about it, like you're on. Yeah, you're good pals and. Do you still kind of share the responsibilities of the dog?
That's the family. That's the whole thing. Like, she dropped the dog to the vet today, so I will have to collect. Like, there's a whole sort of thing there.
Yeah.
But no, I think, to be honest, the dogs were a huge part in why we ended up still being the best of friends, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's played a huge part in it. And we are, you know. I'm very, very lucky in that I've only ever had, you know, every woman I've been has been in my life has been a better person than I am, so it makes breakups fairly easy because we can all just accept it's my fault. I think that's the truth. So I think that Elaine and me have just been like, she is like she's my number one, I suppose, in the world, you know. Still,
yeah,
you know, it's just this person that's like always been there, understands me like very, very, very well.
Yeah,
like she is my best friend. So and it's like we're broke up a while now, so she's with somebody else now, and it's great to be able to be that far in where you can go, oh, I'm so happy that you're
really
happy
healthy.
With this, you know.
Yeah.
Which is feels a bit Hollywood, and maybe if somebody else told me the story, I might not believe it, but
you're living it.
But I'm living it, yeah.
Fair play. And it is mature, and it's not always the easiest thing to do, but fair play.
I know, it's mature now. I mean, obviously, there was like a rough patch there where, like, you know, things were pretty spicy. Like, you know, like a bit like a Vindaloo. It seems like a great idea, and then it's burning the arse off, you know. But, like, we're there. Like, things are good. Yeah, things are very good.
So, this whole pandemic has obviously kind of taught us lessons and been a strange old time. We're still bloody in it. But I believe that you're not a hugger. So you must love this whole non-contact thing that's going on.
Yeah, at the start I thought this was great. And I do love the anti-social distancing. Like, I'm into that. Like, I hope we never go back. Like, I'm into anti-social distancing is something that I am very much a fan of. You know, like, we went mental there where every time we met people, we had to hug and kiss them. Yeah. You know, it was getting weird. Again, like, if your uncle came in, I'd be expected to go up and kiss him on the cheek or something. Like, it was just really, we were losing the run of ourselves. COVID was bound to happen, you know. And I'm not into that. I'm really not into that.
Never.
I don't like it. I don't like it. No, I get weird about personal space, and I don't like being touched, and I don't like any of that. So when COVID happened initially, I was having a laugh. Like, it was that 3 months or whatever where it was like, oh, this is actually a bit of a novelty, and now it's acceptable that we just don't have to touch each other anymore. I was like, this is great, you know. This is great. How naive was that? This is great. We're all getting a few months off work. It's great. And then the reality of it, I think, kicked in, you know. And it's a very different world now. You know, don't exactly want to hug or kiss anyone, but at the same time, it's been so long. Like, it's been so hard. Like, COVID kicked the shit out of me at the end. I'd say the last, after Christmas, I think.
I really got a belt of
I'm struggling here. Like, I'm really struggling here. You know, wasn't able to keep my head up at all. Wasn't able to enjoy anything anymore. Even though you know, you go into this sort of dialogue in your head where you're like, no, I'm going to focus on the good things. And it's all very well. It's all very Dalai fucking Lama. I'll keep a journal and I'll be grand and thing. And then you just start writing down shit that you just can't enjoy anymore. It becomes a very different exercise. And the next thing I was like, sort of going, okay, these are things I appreciate. But it was like, oh, I don't appreciate them. I'm actually just listing more things I don't enjoy because of COVID, you know. So I think it kicked the shit out of me. Like, it really did. It snuck up on me. And then you start to, same as anybody, I suppose, I started, like, you know, opening that beer too many, opening that fucking cake too many, you know, all of that sort of shit. So I'm
now, the signs
slowly,
are not on you.
Huh?
The signs are not on you.
Well, no, I'm slowly getting my life back together now.
I haven't seen you in a while, but you're looking pretty ripped.
I'm not ripped.
Whatever you've been doing during this time. You've been doing something. Have you been doing your own work?
I'm back training a bit again. Yeah, I am back training a bit again. I used to train a lot. And then I stopped. Around Christmas time I stopped. It just all fell away, you know. There was a bit of a, you know, when you're feeling bad, there's a bit of a what's the point sort of thing that creeps in. But no, back again doing bits and pieces, like, yeah.
And that's good for the head.
It's great for the head. It's great for everything. Yeah, it's great for your appetite, for your manners, puts discipline on you. It's great for everything, you know. It gives you motivation to do other stuff. I know it's totally counterintuitive, like, that if working out gives you more energy for the rest of your day. But it really is true. Yeah. Like, you know, it's a bizarre thing, but it does work.
Yeah. I haven't done it myself in a while, but I remember... the deep crevices of my mind.
Well, you're being hard. You're literally carrying another.
I'm growing a human being.
Like, you're carrying another human.
Yeah, but I've been using probably the excuse of the pandemic for a long time.
It's the best excuse ever. Can you imagine if I was pregnant? Imagine me, a man, sitting next to you, 6 months pregnant. Can you imagine the drama? Oh, no shit. I'd be sitting there. Can you imagine the drama? I'd be sitting here and I'd be shouting. I mean, you have no idea what it's like. You'd be getting that for a start. Do you know what it's like being a pregnant man in this town? No one gives a fuck about you. I'd be giving you all of that. And I'll eat what I want to eat, and don't you dare judge me. Like, I'd be full on guns blazing. There you are going, you're being hard on yourself. It's unbelievable.
Well, you are too, and that's something I've always observed about you in interviews, whether it's podcasts or you know, press interviews. You seem to be tough on yourself.
I don't know, am I? I don't.
Yeah, you are. I that's my opinion of you.
Yeah.
Is that, you seem to be somebody that, like, you know, and it's an endearing quality. I think I find you quite self-deprecating, but you even said that there about your ex, like, everyone you've been in a relationship with is better than you. Do you really believe that?
About one or two. I mean, we all have our landmarks. We all look at one and go, oh, yeah, what was I thinking? That was definitely not my fault. You know, we all have them. We all have those people, you go, that one, that was not my fault. That was definitely, I played my part. I definitely added shit to the fire, but it was not my fault. Yeah, so there's definitely that. But I think generally speaking, yeah, I do believe it. Yeah, I've only really had very positive, like, female influences in my life, I think, in general.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so I do think that. I think the reason that I'm really good friends with almost everybody I've ever been with, not that there's a huge list or anything, you know, the handful of people, is because that's the truth. I mean, it was a pretty acknowledgeable sort of thing where I kind of realised I'm the one that's fucking this up, you know. I don't know if you like people cursing on your podcast.
But
I'm the one that's making a mess of this. So I do believe that, yeah. I do, yeah. Generally speaking, I think, I'm very afraid of disappointing people, but I suppose you sort of do what scares you a lot of the time. I focus on that maybe too much, but it's what I've taken away from a lot of relationships is like, you know, I come away from relationships thinking, geez, I can't do this. I'm just really bad at this. This is just something I'm really shit at. But at the same time, you keep trying, you know?
Yeah.
So,
but I wonder, is it that, or is it something else from, like, a, you know, much further back? Obviously, with you being adopted, and you've spoken really openly about reconnecting with your birth parents.
Yeah, yeah.
And your family, that does that give you a little bit of an unsteady grounding?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it does. Because you always feel like you're an accident in somebody's life. I do anyway. I know that.
Okay.
And all the acknowledging of that doesn't really make any difference.
So it doesn't matter what I say or anyone else ever says to you?
No, because it's my fundamental belief.
Is it?
Yes.
Is there any way of reprogramming that, do you think?
No, I don't think so.
You're not? Okay.
I don't think so for me. I always think that I'm always feel like a... I always feel like I'm on the verge of... I don't know, I'm always trying to make up for me existence, I think. Because I always feel like if I haven't fucked up a relationship yet, I will. And that's nobody's fault. I mean, it's just a guttural feeling I cannot get rid of. And yeah. I know it's there, and people say, oh, if you acknowledge it, fine, you can train your reactions different. I've never been able to do it. I quite simply, honestly believe that if I'm in your life, it might be worse off because of it. And I can't really seem to shift that. And I maybe it is because of adoption. Maybe it's because of the madhouse experience. Maybe it's because of, you know... I mean, the simple fact that I was a boy in an all-girls school for the first few years of my life was a weird one. I always felt like I didn't fit in. I still feel like I don't fit in. I get into things and I get throw myself at them. I feel like I can never get enough of them if I feel like there's any belonging at all. You know, and I try and make a home out of things. I don't just get into motorbikes, for instance. I have to make a home. It becomes my whole life, you know.
Yeah.
Becomes this thing that I can attach myself to. It becomes this thing that I have made for myself. But then ultimately, ultimately these things end up being unfulfilling, and then you kind of pull away a bit, you know. And then, of course, I'm always asking for everyone's validation, but as soon as I get it, I don't want it. So that probably goes back to not wanting to be touched by people. I'm always asking for validation. I became a stand-up comedian. I mean, literally my job was to stand up and say, please like me.
Yeah.
And then at the end, I just wanted to run home. As soon as they said yes, I couldn't take it. I still couldn't take it. So maybe that's why my relationships get fucked up, because I go out with someone and I'm asking someone, oh, please love me, please love me. And then as soon as it happens, I cannot function under the expectation that comes with that. I think I function much better in the leave me alone. Yeah. I think
so. The lead up to things. So, like, when you're on the way up, that's a more comfortable space for you, rather than when you've kind of made it, be it in a career or personal life.
Having arrived at anything is where I can't really function. You know? If I'm chasing something, or if I think I can maybe achieve something, or if I think that something is going to fill this hole that I'm always trying to fill, this, you know, oh, this will justify why you're in the world. If I think that I'm onto something like that, then that's fine. I'll chase it and chase and chase it. But then getting there never does, and then it becomes a new thing.
I
think that's why I'm terrible in relationships, you know. I do think so. I suppose your building blocks are what they are, you know. And
there are plenty of people listening who know your story, as it were, and have heard you speak before, but there'll also be people who haven't, so maybe we should give a sense of it now. But essentially, Yes, you were adopted. You were born in Bessborough House.
Yeah, my mother was in Bessborough House, yeah.
Yeah. And then when you were, I think, 27, you met your birth parents.
I did, yeah.
Who actually went on to marry and have...
More children of their own.
After that. So, I mean, that's massive stuff, let's be honest. That's huge.
Yeah, I guess so. But I have to say, in fairness to my parents, that it was handled so well.
Yeah.
There was never a time in my life I did not know that that was the case.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's
so there was never any... Kerplunk moment. There was never a secrecy. Finding out your different moment. There was never any secrets or cloak and dagger or lies or cover ups or anything. And that was a huge thing. That was the one thing they handled absolutely perfectly, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, no parent gets things right, but they handled it so well. Like, so there was never a big realization. And I don't really understand how, but my parents always knew. So they always knew that I had two other brothers or two sisters or that there was other children. Somehow.
Did they tell you that?
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so again, I always knew, like, and even then when I started the search, like, my parents were like, before I started my search, my mother would tell me, like, listen, you gotta go out, and, like, she would sort of scare the shit out of me, actually, because she'd say, you gotta go and find your birth parents, and you gotta find your family, you have to find, if you're from a rock on the ground, you have to find a rock, and for God's sake, what happens if you end up marrying your sister? And I'd be like, Jesus Christ, what happens if I do end up marrying my sister? I said, you get into a fight with your brother. You could be on a football pitch kicking lumps out of each other. That'd be a terrible thing. Jesus Christ, what would you do? And I was like, Jesus, what would I do? You know, I was in a panic then. You know, yeah. There was about 10 years of my life where I was walking around going, have I had it off with my sister? Like, what's... I was in a terrible state. You know, I just didn't know. And then have me and my brother punched the heads off? What has happened, like, in my life? You know,
okay.
I didn't know.
I mean, I know I'm laughing, but
I know, it's funny. It's funny
like, but in a serious way, as a kid. Well, that's kind of scary. Yeah,
the anxiety's around us, and knowing these people are out there and not knowing how to handle it or what to do. And at the same time, wondering, is it the right thing to look, because you don't know what you'll find and they don't know what they'll find. I'm afraid of letting people down too, so, you know, what if they find me and they just see this, you know, this waste of space, this one, you know, like, all these things go through your head, and you just don't, it's very hard to know what is the right thing to do, and very hard to know who you are. And this, of course, branches when you're young, you're imagining that your parents are not normal people, like, whatever you are. It's like, you know, when people say they're reincarnated, did you ever hear this, people that go on about being reincarnated, but they're never reincarnated as being a plumber in the 60s. No, it's always some Greek fucking king or something, you know. There's never, like, I was a plumber in Liverpool, like, they never come back from that. It's only really glorious shit. And it's the same, I think, when you're an adopted kid, you only imagine that your parents could be these big, like, so I used to imagine kings and queens and aliens quite a lot, that there was, like, you know, there was some alien connection or something, you know, as a little kid. This is what goes through your head. And you forget that it's just human beings, like, they're just human beings in a different part, not even of the world, but in a different part of the country you're already in. So, you know, when you try and when it's eventually when you start humanizing how what the whole experience is, that you start going, right, I think I'm ready to go and do the search, you know. And as well, it's also, it's in your back of your head, am I going to ruin these people's lives? Am I going to turn up and just, like, you know, they live their lives, they're doing their thing, they never did anything wrong. Am I going to just walk into their lives now and set fire to it? You know, there's a bit of that too. And, you know, when you start feeling guilty about, am I going to be the one thing, like, you know, do they even talk about me? Who are, like, you know, you just don't know. Yeah, it's okay. The not knowing.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky I met people who are just brilliant people, you know. I'm lucky I just met very good people, you know.
Yeah.
I'm very lucky. Yeah. I think close to an ideal situation that there is what I found. You know, they stayed together. They loved each other. You know, they still had a family. I think that's as good as you can ever hope to get from these experiences, I think.
And that's a gorgeous perspective to have. I would imagine that on the other side of it, you could have had a different perspective, which is, you know, they went on to marry. They went on to have four more kids.
Yeah.
And I wasn't part of the mix. Does that ever go through your head?
Yeah, when you're young, when times are hard, like, you know, it's when times are hard that really does go through the mix. Okay. Yeah, of course. And you start thinking, what was wrong with me? What did I do wrong? Why me? Like, when you find out that you're so different, and it was finding out I was so different. It wasn't, like I told you, it was a gradual thing. But you start, and then, you know, you feel like you're cut loose, you're stranded, you know. Very hard to connect to people then. Very hard to trust anyone, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, what did I do? What did I do? Like, you know, I think a part of my Psyche will always ask that question, you know, like it's not 50-50, it's just under, it bubbles under, you know. Your formative years of your life are where you learn how to react to stuff, you know. So I know that the truth is I couldn't have ended better, really, you know, in a real life, real world situation. It couldn't have ended better to find people who loved each other, got married, had kids, that wanted to see me when I wanted to see them. That's a huge thing, you know, huge thing. Okay. Because, you know, I've met so many people who are adopted and they
have a different experience.
They have like really, really bad experiences. Yeah, and they're still just told, look, I don't want you in my life, you know.
Yeah, God.
And that's a
tough.
Really tough. That must be, I can't imagine how tough that is. Yeah, that you spend your life building up to this moment and then you're told, I don't want to do this. You know, I've never had any of that. I only had good people who opened the door to let me in. And I, you know, I can't be more thankful than that. But at the same time, there's just is the irrational, emotional side to me that says, well, what the fuck did I do wrong here?
Yeah. And will that ever go away, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, no, I don't know. I don't think so. I think at this stage, I'm 46 years old. Like, if I haven't gone away at this stage, it's not going to go away. I'm a middle-aged man. Like, I react to things the way I react to things. I see myself the way I see myself. I feel the way I feel, you know. Maybe I can handle, you know, I'll get those reactions and then maybe I'll learn to deal with them differently, but I don't think it'll ever go away. No, I don't.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's just how I react to things now. Yeah. You know, there's like, I'm still doing the same shit. I'm still out there doing the same things. I'm still living the same patterns, doing the same, repeating them over and over again. So I don't know.
So say with me now, right, so we're sitting here having this conversation, but maybe not even me, but anyone you meet, because your disposition is very sunny, I suppose. You know, you've got a gorgeous big smile. You're very open and you're very warm. You're very friendly. I've always felt that anytime I've ever met you in person. But do you kind of are suspicious? Are you suspicious of people? Like, you know, because you've mentioned a kind of a distrust of people.
Well, I get suspicious of people.
Do you?
Yeah. If you want to do, if you know, people who are very, I'm always afraid of owing people a favour.
Okay.
I'm always, you know, afraid.
You don't get anything for free in this world, is that it?
Yeah, always like, what do you want? Okay. You know, what do you want? Like,
so if someone is being nice to you.
I don't mind being nice to me.
If
someone says, let me sort this out for you, or I'll do this for you, or I'll do that for you. I hate people helping me. That's what it is.
Okay.
I love I like being friendly with people.
Yeah.
I love meeting people. I love small talk. I know a lot of people hate small talk. I love small talk.
Okay.
We're getting nothing done. I would talk to everybody. I swear to God, I would talk to you here for every day for 6 months if I thought we'd get nothing done. I love that. Love that we're getting nothing done. Yeah. You know, I love that. But as soon as it gets to the point where people are helping, then I feel like I owe them.
Okay.
And then it feels like I can't escape. You know, and when
so does it be kind of claustrophobic?
Yeah, that's why I struggle in relationships. I think, you know, I start feeling like I owe, and then I can't escape.
God, okay. You know. So, are you controlling? Is it a strong word?
No,
you know?
Far from it. Actually, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Far from control.
Yeah.
Other way. You know the way they say you have a fight or flight.
Yeah, response.
Response.
Mm.
I am, and it took me a long, long time to learn this about myself because my idea of myself is very different to the reality. But I am flight every time.
All right, I get you.
Every time, every fucking time, flight, run, go, leg it. Yeah. Every single time. And I thought I was fighting, but I wasn't. I was only annoying myself. When you're nice to me, I'm thinking, you're up to something, go. Like, you know, my social scissors, I am the best social scissors man in the world. Mm. I only ever fight with people one time in my life, that's it.
You'll never get a second chance.
New sim, new me, gone. We have one fight. Because I'm doing everything I can to make you happy. And then if we have a fight, well, I can't ever do that again. So, the social scissors comes out. Like, if I say to you, I am never speaking to you again, I can pretty much be sure that will never happen again. So, and that's because I'm terrified, you know. But I'm afraid of owing you something.
Okay. What do you make of that phrase, you know, the self-fulfilling prophecy? You know, people say, if you say things often enough,
yeah,
you're kind of putting it into existence. So
yeah,
when you're saying these things all the time, I'm always this, I'm always that. Do you think you're always just kind of going to be that because you keep saying it?
Maybe there's truth to that. But I think for me, if that means doing all the work, I probably won't do the work. So I guess I start focusing on this acceptance.
Okay.
For me, it's just trying to accept.
This is it.
That this is who I am.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think that for me is a bigger thing, you know.
When I listen to you, I go, because all I see, and I'm sure this is said to you a lot, is that great guy, so much going for him. But is there somewhere deep down a little bit of a lack of self-worth?
Yeah. That's what the validation, I think, of doing. I think that's like a lot of the stand-up and stuff like that, you know, was just... I tell you, there's always... So my whole life, you can sum it up in one sentence. Like, it's just trying to find one thing I was good at. That's it. Try and find one... Anything. It could have been that, and I didn't give a shit. I just had to try and find something that I was good at.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, I tried a lot of shit. Like, I mean, I had to be bad at a lot of stuff first, you know. Like, genuinely everything, you know. So, like, I wanted to play football for Dublin. I really, really wanted to play football for Dublin. But I can't catch a ball unless it's with my face. So straight away, that was gone. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I threw myself at that. I really wanted to impress my dad with that, you know. I always was trying to get my dad's attention. Like, you know, but it was 1970s, 1980s Dublin. Growing up, it's very hard to get your dad's attention regardless, you know. And my dad was like one of those men. He was 28. He looked 48. He was walking around the beach in a suit with a home over, okay, you know, like, yeah, you know, yeah, very, yeah, very hard to get the man's attention. But I couldn't do it. You know, I couldn't play football. I couldn't do that. So I went to school and I was not fairly academic. I couldn't do it, you know. I couldn't sit down and think. I still can't, you know. As people say, oh, you wrote this show, you wrote that show. I did my bollocks. I stood in a room and talked to myself and, like, you know, put post-its on a wall. I still can't sit down and write stuff. And then I went to do, you know, so many other things. Motorbike racing is something that I love so much, but I was never going to be good enough to be a pro racer or something. But the one thing I was always able to do was tell stories, you know.
Yeah.
Was I always able to express myself? You know, one way or the other, I could always express myself, and it was always seen as negative. So even then, I found this one thing I could do really, really well,
yeah,
but it was seen as disruptive and negative. So I guess then you spend your life, your childhood, trying to find this one fucking thing you can do. And then as soon as you find it, you're told you're bad. And I guess that has an impact where you go, right, I've confirmed it now. I really am a bit shit. You know, the one thing I'm good at is being in the way, you know, once again. You know, but then stand-up arrived, and for the first time ever, I'll never forget it, like, the first time ever doing the stand-up show and being kind of shit and thinking, but there's something in this.
Yeah.
I don't even like it. Yeah. I don't like stand-up. Yeah, I would never go to a stand-up show, but I remember thinking, there's something in this. Something happened there. There was something. There was a bit of magic. Something happened.
Yeah.
And then going back to the international, I remember going back to the international, and it was on straight after the break where they put the newcomers, you know.
Mm.
And it was me, and I think Barry Murphy was on, and Kevin Gildee was on, you know, it was all the old original guys,
yeah,
from back in the day.
Yeah.
And going on and doing this gig and blowing the roof off the place.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's fucking it.
This is it.
I'm good at something.
Yeah.
Do you like it? No. But I'm good. I can do it. So there's this course then that everything I liked, I wasn't good at, but this one thing came along that I don't really like too much. I don't really care about it, but I was able to do it, you know, for the first time ever, I felt like I was not just good at something, but it was actually had value to it.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Isn't that interesting how, as you said, like, because I know you've spoken about loving radio now, and, you know, you do your telly work, you do your different things, and you've your passions, you know, motorbike racing, whatever it is, and with football and everything. But then you excelled in comedy and have done and still do. And yet you didn't really feel it.
No, I never
That's
loved
interesting.
It. No, because the anxiety, again, the expectation, getting on stage every night and thinking you're going to ruin everyone's weekend, you know. Thinking to yourself, like, I couldn't do a Vicar Street show without thinking there's 1,100 people out there and I could ruin all their weekends. I could never remove myself.
Couldn't quieten that voice.
From that voice. Never. Okay. Never.
Even when you came down to, like, mad laughter, tears in eyes, people just, like, screaming, roaring, clapping for you. Was that voice ever going, you did it?
No, no, for in those moments.
Yeah. But they were short, is it?
Really short.
Okay.
To the point that I had to get out of the room immediately.
Oh, you weren't able for the praise after?
Oh, no. So I used to do gigs with all the support acts I would do gigs with. So when it really started flying after the Naked Camera years, when I was doing the Vicar Streets and the sold out theatres and everything.
Yeah.
So I would always tell the support act that was on, this is going to be my last joke. So when I say this, start the car.
All right.
So they would go, okay, so I would say, so I would go into it. And I would know from the second I started that routine that the back door to the venue was open and the car engine was running.
That's back to the flight thing again.
And that's back
Gone.
To flight. Get
Gone.
Out of here.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here.
Okay.
So in the moment of it, in those last few moments of a gig where you knew you blew the roof off the place, where people were having a great time, that was like, you know, you didn't let anyone down. You did good. They had a good time. Now get the fuck out of here. You know, jump into the car and go. I mean, go. I would be in the car down the road before even they would be out of their seats.
Wow.
Most nights. Every night, I would say, to be honest. Like, even when we were playing the festivals, I would never sit in the green rooms with the other acts. I would always sit with the people who were working there before the gigs, because I couldn't stand the talk about the gigs, and I couldn't stand the talk about the, you know, what people were going to do and what we were doing next. And, oh, Jesus Christ, next? Are you joking me? Next? I'm doing this next? Like, I have to do half an hour here in a minute, you know, let me swallow that first,
let's get through this.
Yeah. And we also used to, you know, I would always be quite envious of the confidence of the other lads who loved it and who couldn't wait to get on stage.
Yeah, interesting. But I suppose we all have our own process, especially entertainers, you know, whether you're a stand-up comedian or an actor who's, you know, taken to the stage, whatever it is. Everybody has their own process. Some people go very quiet, don't want to be around anyone. Other people love the distraction of
it. Love the chat.
And as somebody who's worked behind the scenes on things, be it an MC or whatever, I see it. I see it in musicians and singers, in keynote speakers. Everyone is so different.
No, I do gigs with the likes of Carl Spain, and Carl Spain was unbelievable. Like, he would literally be talking to you in the middle of a conversation as he walks onto the stage. Like, he's still looking back. They've called his name and he's like, I'll just finish this. And he would tell you at the end of a story as he's walking backwards up to the microphone, and then he'd turn around and go, hey, here's it going. I'd be like, how in the name of God does anyone have confidence like that?
Yeah.
How does anyone have that confidence? You know, I would be so envious of the likes of Neil Delamere, who are a joke writer. Like, he can just sit down before a gig and he'll write shit down on a piece of paper, and then he'll get up and he'll just try it and it will work. I was like, how do you do that? Like, the confidence that took. You know, I had to go out and have something happen and then, you know, torture myself for an entire day for where's the joke? It's going to be shit. Where is it? It's not going to work. Bang, it worked. Oh, shit, get me out of here. You know.
Did you ever think, though, so you might look at them and not necessarily be envious, but think, like, how do they do that? That's brilliant. But do you ever think that they looked at you and thought, how does he do what he does.
Well, yeah, but that, yeah, well, I, yeah, because I suppose in fairness, that's something I wouldn't take for myself. People were, I knew I was doing just one thing other people
weren't
doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I knew I was good at it.
Yeah, I know.
I just couldn't enjoy it. I knew I was good at it though. Like I was good at it. But I was still waiting to I still couldn't, I thought of, I'm going to get up here and ruin everyone's weekend. The thoughts of it. Every time I get on stage, I'm going to ruin their night. Oh, I'm going to fucking ruin their night. The thoughts of it running through my head all day. These people have paid 25 quid in and I'm going to wreck it. You know, they couldn't get rid of it. They just couldn't get rid of it.
So basically, if you could quieten that voice in your head,
yeah,
you'd like it. You'd probably enjoy it.
Hmm.
Okay.
I would say so, yeah. But I'm gigging over 20 years.
I know, yeah. And I've heard that you're kind of like not really pushed if you ever do it again now.
Oh, no. I don't really want to put myself through that again.
Yeah, you're kind of done.
But I don't know if that's realistic. I mean, it's Ireland. It's not like I've done 20 years of stand-up and I have millions in the bank. I still have to pay the bills.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
And when you're funny for money, you still have to pay the rent.
Yeah, of course.
So there's all of that. Like, yeah. So I'll see. But at the moment, I'm lucky enough that I'm doing radio. And
you're doing
a few
your TV
bits
work. You had your DIY show.
And the DIY party. Show and a few bits that could come in. And have been coming in, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same breath, I'll say to you, I'm very lucky I have all of these things. But and like I feel, and I know that's true, and I enjoy it. But at the same breath, I'll tell you, my biggest fear is poverty. Like I still think I'm going to end up with nothing.
Okay.
With not a pot to piss in at the end of the month.
Okay, is that a consistent worry?
That's the most consistent worry. That is the most consistent worry that keeps me up at night.
Yeah.
You know, I still, even in the grand scheme of things, have this, you're going to fuck it up fear, you know. I can't get rid of it.
Okay.
Yeah. This is therapy session now. Like, I mean, I feel like I should be giving you money for this. I feel like I should definitely, this is at least 90 euros worth right now, isn't it? This is definitely 90 quids worth. Like, if I was in the Hermitage Clinic now, I'd be banging out fucking hundreds for this. You know what I mean? Hundreds, like.
Come here, you mentioned Madhouse and, you know, you did a brilliant, very successful play. Unfortunately, I never saw it, but I heard brilliant reviews of it.
Yeah, it was good crack. It was good crack. And it went well.
And it was Catherine Lynch that played
my ma.
Your mother in
the
Maria.
The character of my ma, yeah. And I was so proud of Madhouse. Because we were the first, and I would say only play in the Abbey Theatre where we had Dublin jerseys in the audience. You know, like we brought an audience to the Abbey Theatre that would never be at the Abbey Theatre, you know. And I'm really proud of that. Like, and like it's based on that other experience in my life. So I was adopted and then I was put into foster care. Mm. I was in foster care for 6 months. I don't know where that was. That's lost. That's gone in time. Don't know where that was. But after that, I was adopted by my parents. And my dad had a pub, but the pub was gone. And as my ma took on, it was this, the Eastern Health Board, as it was known at the time,
before the
HSC, they had this experiment, basically. And it was an experiment to see, can you put people with mental health problems back into the community? But like, this is all in today's language. Like, mental and health were not
a thing.
Two words that were ever used side by side.
Yeah.
Like in the show, we say in the 80s, you were either mental or you had health. That's it. There was no mental health, you know. And then, so they took these people who are schizophrenic, essentially, six schizophrenic people, and they were put into the house with me and my family, you know.
Like, that's a risky move, isn't it?
It was very well intended, but let's be honest, it was the most ridiculous, like, it was a wild thing to do, right?
Yeah, for everyone involved.
For them, for us, for our family, for the dog even. Like, it was a strange environment for us all together. We all lived in this, like, tempest together. So, like, me, my mom, my dad, my sister, the dog were on one side of the house, and then there was these six people, and they would change, you know, every so often.
Okay.
One would, you know, well, unfortunately, one might die or would be moved on to a different place, and then we get someone else new, you know. So we had this really mad home dynamic.
And that went on for about 9 years, didn't
it? Yeah. Nine or 10 years.
And what age were you when it started?
Oh, I was only young. I mean, I was very young. Like, we left Marino, I was only, Jesus, what age was I? Was I 7 or 8?
Okay.
So, like, yeah, like, no, I was later than that, maybe. So about 10, I'd say, because it went right up until my dad died, really.
And when did your dad die again? Late 90s?
Yeah, he died in 99, my dad died, yeah.
Yeah.
So it was longer then. It was about 15, 16 years. It was long. Like, it was a long time. Like, it was a prolonged part of the formative years of our lives, you know?
Yeah. And that became your normal.
It became a normal, yeah. And, like, you're talking about, like, so you're talking about coming home from school and, for instance, like, you had six people there. Like, one person who was ultra, so paranoid, he just thought there was somebody trying to attack him all the time. He was, like, you know, constantly hiding behind corners and, like, you know, hiding behind trees in the garden and all this shit, you know. Had this really weird movement pattern that he used to do, and then there was another man who thought there was a dog living inside him. Okay. There was another man who thought he was going to be beaten up by this other person who didn't even exist in the house. Another guy who saw a gorilla constantly. So, you know, you're coming home from school and you're chasing away imaginary gorillas, like you're taking people out of hedges. You know, Jesus. it was a very bizarre existence,
and it is absolutely. When you say it now, like I'm trying to not piss myself laughing because it sounds so mental. It is hilarious, but not if you're feckin' living it, I suppose.
Oh, well, yeah, I know, but it was very funny times.
Did you laugh?
You know, you
it?
Did, and they did too. Okay. I mean, a lot of they realised, like, people who have schizophrenia, they are very aware of most of what's happening, you know.
Okay,
so
yeah,
they
yeah.
knew that this was a weird situation, you know. Like, yeah, you know, I would sit down with some of the lads sometimes, and they would be like, "Your poor mother, I know. I'd be like, I know my poor mother. Like, she's looking after our fucked up dysfunctional family and you." And he'd be like, "Yeah, I know. And like, and your man's in the hedge again." I'd be like, "I know he's in the hedge. I have to get him out of the fucking hedge." Like, you know, and he's like, "Well, you better go. I'll leave you at it." And then he'd go off and have whatever problems he had. And then, you know, you're pulling the man out of the hedge and the other guy is around the far side of the garden fucking barking. Like, it was wild. Like, it was, you know.
Yeah.
And then you're like, it got to, you know, my man would be handing out the food and I'm like, you know, trying to get the medication right. You know, I'm a teenager. Like, I don't know what happens, you know. And then, God forbid, my elf was left in charge. She's just like, he'd be just like looking at people thinking, "My God, you know, maybe he takes a blue pill and hope for the best." Like it was chaos.
So your dad wasn't hands on with
them? No, my dad wasn't hands on.
Okay,
no, my elf was the type of fellow who turned a Hoover on and sat next to it with a beer and a glass. Like, you know,
okay.
Like he was very much. And then my dad would have to take them to mass. So my dad had this car, like this old Ford Cortina, you know.
Yeah.
Like the regular Cortina. And like him, so there's like the seven men in this fucking thing going to St. John's Church in Clontarf. Like, and them all piling out. And then, of course, none of them got to mass. They all just gobbled out and walked away. Including me, Elfella, who just go to the fucking pub. You know, and then they come back and you're like, "What's going on here?" Like, people, and then me ma's like, "Where are they?" "I don't know." Like, it was just absolutely bats.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and some people would just, you know, one guy, Danny, would just get out of the car and come home. And he didn't want to go to mass in the first place. What are you making forcing grown adults to go to mass for? Like, in the, well, you know, forcing, like, why that's even a part of the schedule of the day. You know, it gets to Sunday and every man in this house must go to mass. You know, I'm like, I'll cycle as if I never went near the fucking place. Like, I was there, I'd come down there. And like, people saying to you, "You know, your man that lives down the road and he's always like jumping in and out of the lane and all." Because I'm not, no, I'm I fucking fed him. Like, I live with him, you know. Like, it was
God,
completely bonkers, like, you know. And at the same time, I was in an all-girls school before that. So I was the first, I was the lad that went to the all-girls school. And then I was, my parents left very late to enroll me in school. And then I ended up being in the Holy Faith. So it was me, there was five boys in the whole school. You know, so it was me and four other lads.
Right.
And like, you want to see me communion pictures. It's just me and everyone in dresses. They're all just in dresses. And me there with my white ribbon and in a pair of shorts and a suit jacket. Like something out of Miami Vice. It's the weirdest thing. And then straight out of that environment, into the madhouse environment, you know, so it sets you up. What chance do you have except for a career in comedy? Like, it's just going to be, it's a different life.
Well,
you
certainly have oodles of brilliant material at hand. Like,
I don't know, maybe there's a book in it or something. I don't know.
I definitely think there is. I definitely think there is. Because it's almost hard to believe that it happened, but it did. As you said, it was a form of a kind of a social experiment. And you were one of only kind of four homes, wasn't it?
I thought
in the country
there was houses all over Ireland
doing this.
I thought this was
commonplace.
The what we do in Ireland. Yeah. You know, you can't look after yourself. They find someone who'll look after you, much like myself, you know. And turns out there was only a handful of houses around the country, like hardly any houses.
And your mother was a nurse, but she wasn't a psychiatric nurse. So she wasn't trained to deal with it.
No, she was a regular nurse in Liverpool and London and a hairdresser before that. And then no one had the training for this. And like it was a handful of houses. They had to stop the scheme eventually because people were taking advantage of these people. Like that, there's a really serious dark side to it as well. Like these people were going to people's houses and then they were being made to use to work and you know.
Oh God, right.
So there was a lot, there's a real dark side to it as well. And so the scheme had to be ended. Quite recently I was doing this thing, this men's mental health chat, you know, after having this podcast, I'm wondering why they asked me, like. but I was doing this thing and one of the lads on it, his ma was the nurse who used to call around and do the checkups on our house, and he's working in the mental health sort of system today.
Yeah, I getcha.
And he was asking me, like, did you ever think about it? I was there, are you serious? I couldn't wait to start to get out of that. I couldn't wait for that to get out of that house.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was in the same. He grew up in the same sort of system, but he loved it. He stayed the rest of his whole life. He stayed in it. His mother had people in the house as well, and he lived in it. And he just wanted to keep that in him. He's still working away in the mental health environment. I couldn't get out of it fast enough.
Yeah.
But then I suppose, I mean, I was as bad as anyone in the house, you know, a teenager. Who wants to live with a teenager? So, I mean, imagine like you had your own mental health issues and you're in your 70s and then you're living with a teenager. Like, I mean, they really had a lot to put up with, like.
Yeah. But, God, it's mental, but it's also fascinating. Did you ever go to sleep at night and be worried, you know, as in, you know, it's all well and good you telling this and talking about your man who was barking like a dog and your man who thought he saw, you know, a gorilla and somebody else hiding behind the hedges. And it is comical when you talk about it because it's so outrageous. But on a serious note, then you're going to bed at night. Did you ever worry like there was something going to happen that was going to put your safety at risk?
No.
I suppose what I'm going to say. No,
no, never. They were vulnerable people. Like, they were very vulnerable people. They were, like, people who needed to be cared for. Like, and I think that's the thing. A lot of people, things with mental health and all of that is that people, you know, people are, even, I learned that lesson early, that mental health is nothing to be afraid of in other people. Like, it's, to, you know, these were not dangerous people. These were people who were vulnerable. These were like the most vulnerable people I have ever met in my life. In my life. There is literally, the men that lived with us were in a system that couldn't look after them before they ever even got to my house. Some of them had been through horrific stuff in their lives.
Yeah.
They were completely and utterly the most vulnerable people I have ever met. Like, I meet 10-year-olds who have more worldly experience and know how to look after themselves better than these people. These people were so vulnerable, you know. And so there was never any fear on my part. I would say, if anything, they were afraid. Having teenagers come into the house and, you know, like the unpredictability of our family a lot of the time. I would say put fear in. Me and my sister. And my old man and my mom, whatever goes, you know, all families are nuts and they have their moments and all of this. I would say, if anything, they were afraid. Okay. I would say the terror they must have had being told, you're being put in a fucking house with a family you've never met before.
Mm.
And that's, this family growing up, they must have been, it must have been so overwhelming for someone who has the issues that they had, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was the other way. It was definitely the other way around. I think about them every so often. I think probably not many of them must be alive anymore, if any. And I think they must have been terrified of the environment they were in, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So
does that make you more compassionate then towards people with mental illness?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Does it? I don't know. Maybe I just understand it a little bit more.
Yeah, because you've had experience
because you grow up seeing it, you know. Maybe I just understand it a little bit more, you know, that it's nothing to be afraid of, and that it is not if you don't have it. I mean, it's obviously a very frightening thing if you do, but it does make me think about, you know, the way a lot of the mental health awareness today, always feels like it excludes people like that for me. Because I, like, you know, a lot of mental health awareness, a lot of it focuses on anxiety and depression and all these things, and you know, that's fine. But right now, like, there was walking around, there's people who, one guy we lived with used to see his dead brother in the shop standing next to him, you know.
Yeah.
And you don't really hear
people
say, oh, that's okay, don't worry, it's okay to be okay with that. You don't really hear about people saying, listen, if you have severe mental trauma, like, happening now, like, you're, like that. You know, it always feels like they're kind of left out of the conversation a little bit, to be honest.
It's a very good point.
You know, I did, like the mental health is not just anxiety and depression. Mental health is there's an awful lot more. There's some severe mental health issues that are I still don't hear people talk about it at all.
Yeah, you're right. We don't.
You know, and we're speaking no more about them now than we did back in those days. You know.
Yeah.
So it does feel like that to me. You know, it feels like there's still a huge amount of people in the mental health sort of spectrum that are
forgotten,
just not included. You know.
Yeah, which isn't good.
So maybe it just makes me a little bit more understanding.
Aware.
I don't know. I really don't.
Well, definitely straight away. I kind of shows my own ignorance by asking that question because your response was so quick. You know, I suppose I was just thinking again. I was just thinking of it from one perspective rather than seeing it from the other.
Well, it's probably just because we don't talk about it. But then, like, it's I don't know. I don't come out of it very. I mean, I come out of it with my own mental health issues, I suppose. You come out of that house and that experience too. My own anxieties. Talk about learning how to catastrophize. Like, you know, when you're going home and every other day there's an ambulance outside your house or something crazy is happening, you do learn to expect the worst, you know.
Yeah.
So you develop your own relationship with anxiety, you know. You know. So was I afraid? Yeah, I was terrified going to bed. But not of those people. I was just terrified of what might happen, like, you know.
Yeah, okay.
What crazy thing is going to happen in this house next? But
and is that going back to the kind of the fight or flight? Were you always kind of in that? Do you operate a lot of the time? You know, we hear about people speak about the parasympathetic system and the sympathetic system. So it's the nervous system. One is calm, it's the rest and digest, and the other one is the adrenaline fueled fight or flight, where you're always on.
Right.
Are you always on?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that before. I guess so, yeah. I suppose I am, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose, yeah, I still am, yeah. I guess so. Always waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah, I think I am, yeah.
So, yeah, look, this has been, a brilliant conversation. I'm conscious of the fact that I probably have asked you some kind of left-of-centre questions as well. But I did want to ask you one thing. If it's okay.
Yeah.
Because we're hearing a lot about Bessborough in the news, particularly over the past year or so in particular. How do you feel about it?
I don't know how I feel about it. I guess for me, you see, it's not new news.
Yeah.
You know, this has been with me all my life. Like, you know, all my life, I knew that there was this place that my mother was in. And then, you know, because of the system I was born, you know, and so I guess there's nothing new in that for me. And like I was on Ray Darcy's show on Today FM just a few years back, you know.
Yeah.
And I said it to him about Bessborough House and he hadn't a clue what I was talking about, you know. And I think that was the moment that I started doing. It was after I started doing interviews like this. Beforehand, I would always just do interviews and try and tell you what you wanted to hear or whatever. You know, I wasn't really honest in them. It was just like, how do I make this as entertaining as possible, you know.
Yeah, I getcha.
In fact, I would probably try and deflect anything. From my personal life, to be honest, you know. And I remember saying that to him and then suddenly seeing his interest, actually, and then thinking, all right, this is actually, people don't know this story. People don't know that this was a thing. So it was very unusual for me then when it all came out, all the news and all the stories came out, and people were suddenly asking me, oh, how do you feel? It's like, well, I feel the same as I felt for forever.
Yeah.
But in a weird way, it was hard to take because, I don't know, it kind of feels like it's not my story to tell. It kind of feels like it was taken from me a little bit, and it should have been, because it should be about the women who were there. I mean, that's first and foremost, the women who were there and the kids who didn't make it out of these places, you know. And I suppose it's very much a women's issue. So I kind of get, I'm at a point where I'm afraid to talk about it in some ways because I don't really feel like it's mine. And it makes it hard to talk about, you know. I get emotional now when I think about it because I start thinking, do I actually have any right to talk about this? You know, I don't remember it. I wasn't really there, you know. My mother was there. But at the same time, it's sort of formed my whole life.
Yeah.
But then talking about it as a man, I feel like it's not really I don't know if I'm allowed to or something. I feel like it's not my story, you know. And it makes it hard to talk about for me then. In this is the only element of anything really that I find hard to talk about, because it's like, where, even now in a way, I think it is. And even now, even in this story, I still don't fit in, you know. Even in this story, I still feel like I don't fit in. So it's very hard to, it's a really hard question to answer. I wish I knew. I wish I had some memories. I wish I had something. I don't.
Yeah.
All I know is it's where I began, you know. That's where my story begins, is in this place. But there's a bit of survivor's guilt to it. Okay. Especially when you fear that so many people didn't make it. And then so many kids never got out. And then here I am then pissing and moaning with you for the last hour.
But you're not.
I know, but it feels like, I know, and I know this isn't real, but there's this guilt. I'm like, you know, if you're not enjoying every certain single aspect of your life, then you should be paying, you know, it just feels like you're taking things for granted. And then I hear the interviews of the women who were there, and then I hear other people's stories, and their stories are so much worse than mine again, and I feel guilty. You know, I do feel guilty, yeah. Sometimes I feel very guilty about it. Sometimes I do, yeah.
Okay.
And I think maybe that's a bit of why I'm trying to justify my existence again. All the fucking time. I guess that's as honest as I can answer the question. I don't know if that's not even really much of an answer for you, to be honest. But it's hard, you know, to think about it. It's about, because, you know, there's a part of me that thinks, geez, everywhere you went, you've made life difficult for people, you know. Yeah, I'm here, you know. Yeah, I'm alive. Yeah, I've done all right. You know, I've great people in my life.
Yeah.
But I'm still finding a way to walk around being miserable a lot of the time. And I kind of feel like that gives me guilt, you know.
And I suppose it's pointless, people like me saying to you, you're hard on yourself. And if all the people that you're connected to, that you're friends with, that love you, I'm guessing would not say the shit that goes on in your head about you. It just seems like you're so hard on yourself. And you are such a gorgeous person. And obviously you've brought so much light into people's lives through your comedy work. And then you're on radio every morning. You're you know, you wake Dublin up. You know, you bring a lot of good to the world. You know,
I try to.
Yeah,
working against trying to be a negative force. You know,
when you let yourself feel it, let it in. You know that you are worthy of it, and you are a good person, and you do deserve good things.
When do I do that?
When will you let yourself?
When will I do that?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, I definitely need to pay you for this. Like, this is definitely like we're running into the thousands of euro at this stage. This is one of those. This is one of that. That is the ultimate therapist question. After an hour's chat, look at that. Almost bang on the time I'd be thrown out of a therapist cell, and you've left me with that banger to walk down the road with now. You know, I don't honestly, I don't know. And honestly, if that question is ever answered fully, what'll I do then? You know, who will it be then? You know, what happens then?
Yeah.
Like, what does that even look like? You know, I don't know.
Okay, let's forget I even asked that.
I'll just go riding bikes and hoping for the best.
Yeah, and look at, so, is that stuff that makes you happy in your life? Because, you know, I know you're pretty good in the kitchen by the sound of things.
Yeah, I love cooking.
Yeah, you love being on your bikes. You love your dogs. You've got a great circle of people around you. You've got a job that you like doing. You know, life's pretty good.
Life's pretty good, yeah. I'm terrified of it all ending, but genuinely life is pretty good. I mean, I have, you know, those are things, it's those things that do give me, you know, that make me happy, you know. I love going, like, like the pandemic was hard because it doesn't, there's these small things that do make me happy all the time. Like, I fucking love going to matches. I love going to see Bows playing. I love going to see the Dubs playing. Nothing makes me happier than it. I love it. I love that feeling of being a part of something that is bigger than me. Mm. You know, I love all that. I love walking my dogs. I love being around animals in general. I love feeling their company and feeling appreciated. When do I feel like a good person? When I'm around my fucking dogs. There's your answer now, Smarty Pants. When I'm around my dogs, I feel like number one. You know, I love that. I love that. I love being on a motorbike. I love that I'm going to get on a motorbike in my jeans and jacket, be too fucking hot, going down the road for a while until I cool down, and then I have the whole world at my feet. I love the sense of freedom that gives me, you know.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that the people in my life, I love that I haven't totally given up on myself. I'm trying to give a new relationship a go at the minute. I'm bound to fuck it up, but I'm having a shot. I'm having a shot. Fuck it. Why not?
Yeah,
you know, I love that I'm still good mates with Elaine, that I haven't, you know, disappointed everybody I've ever met. So genuinely, when you break it all down, when you look at it, like, these are things to be really, really happy about. You can't do them properly at the moment because of the poxy pandemic, but it's coming back around.
Yeah.
So I love those things, you know. I love that I'm going to go home and cook myself some decent food, you know. I can appreciate the smaller things in life, you know.
Yeah, brilliant. You know,
big picture, I'm scared of me shite. Genuinely, day to day, I'm okay.
Yeah. Well, look, isn't it brilliant that you're so honest, because, you know, a lot of people aren't as honest as you. And
you're probably too honest, am I? Did I freak you out
brilliant.
Now?
You didn't freak me out at all. This has been an amazing conversation. You are bloody brilliant, and I feel really lucky that you were so willing to go there, because you could have told me to feck off on numerous occasions during this conversation and you would have been within your rights to do so. So thanks.
Well, that would have been rude.
You could have said, well, I'm not going there. Don't ask me that. And that you would have been within your rights to do that. So so thank you. I just think you're a great guy, and I think you're way too hard on yourself. But I'm also excited to see what you do next, because I know that maybe stand up is something that you will or won't do, but you're going to continue doing great things. And the more I think you're just being yourself and real, you know, it's just fascinating, to be honest, where it's going to go next.
We'll see. God knows. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. Fingers crossed it's not shit.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And if you like my podcast, please consider showing your support. It only takes a minute or two, and I would be so grateful. You can leave a rating or a little comment on Apple, or you can simply click follow on Spotify. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.